Hi, and welcome to Parent Talk hashtag with Bev. This is the beginning of, well, for me, 2024. And I have been spending time thinking about the vision of where my podcast should go, as well as taking time out to think about my work, my life. Just recently suffered a bereavement in my family, which has made me rethink a lot of things. And one thing that has remained is the need to continue these podcasts regardless, and to sort of try and get back on track. So, first of all, I want to say sorry for all the people who have been listening to my podcast and wondering where I've disappeared to. I'd like to say I'm back. I'll just take it moment by moment at this time. So, for my first interview, I am being joined by a special guest who will explain who she is and what she does and why she does. And I think it's a really important podcast for us to hear. So I need to warn you, there's a trigger alerts around this interview. We are speaking about domestic violence, and we will put in the bio some links for the organization that we're talking about, but also any information that's available to signpost listeners too. So that being said, do the podcast how you do the podcast, whether you're sitting down with a cup of something to drink or a glass of Chardonnay, my darlings, or for example, if you're going on a run or you're just doing the housework, I would ask you to follow and share the podcast as well. That'll help the channel grow. And also, if you want to tell your experience as well so that others can learn from it, please feel free to DM me. I do have an Instagram as well called Parent Talk hashtag with Bev, as well as leave comments so that we can begin to, chat and learn together. So, with that said, I'd like to go into the interview, and I hope that you learn something. And if you're experiencing any domestic violence, that you will listen to a sister who has been along that journey but has moved out of it. And if you want to be an ally, you can contact that organization as well and lend your support. Let's look out for each other. And I'll lead straight into the interview.
Okay.
So I just would like to welcome our guest. She'll tell you her name and everything as we get into it. So would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Hello, my name's Ornella. I'm a 29-year-old single mother of one child.
And you live in London?
Yes, I live in London.
And what do you do? What kind of work do you do?
So I currently manage a youth service where I work with 6 to 19 year olds running after school provisions, including things like tutoring, football lessons, cooking, arts and crafts, and stuff like that. I also founded a grassroots organization, which I'm in the process of turning into a charity called Sanctuary for Sisterhood.
Now, I saw you, or I met you a few weeks back at an event, and I was so inspired by the way in which you were speaking in that space that I felt that it was really important for other people to hear your story and what you're doing. You said Sanctuary for Sisterhood. What is it? What's that?
So Sanctuary for Sisterhood is an organization that I kind of founded. It's kind of born from my own experiences of domestic violence and my experiences of sort of navigating services thereafter. Like I said, at the event that you met me at, I found myself feeling too black for some services, too strong for others, too loud for the rest. And I just thought, I can't be the only one that feels like this. I can't be the only one that's been through a 6 week or a 2 month program and still don't feel healed, but feel too afraid to go back to the service and let them know that. I started to feel like maybe there was something wrong with me. Why am I not healing? Why am I not better? Why am I still finding myself in relationships where they may not necessarily be violent, but they're still abusive in some way, or they've got their own trauma that they're bringing into the relationship? And after quite a lot of psychotherapy, and counseling, I was able to recognize that it was actually a few things. Not only was the domestic violence kind of already innate in me, it was also the fact that there is something in domestic violence that it stays with you. So you can't heal after 6 weeks or 2 months. It stays with you for a long time, and it's about a continuity of support, a continuity of services. So that's kind of where I felt like my charity could fill a gap. What was missing was there was nothing that offered you a, okay, so today you're feeling a bit crap, come over, we're running this today and you can get involved in that, and that can support your healing. We're not saying that you're going to be fixed after a day, but we're saying that you can become part of a sisterhood that whenever you need us, we're there in whatever way we can be it via WhatsApp, be it through a phone call, be it through a face-to-face one-to-one or a group session or a workshop, or even coming to an event where we're able to reach you or connect you with the right people or refer or signpost you.
So you're saying, I mean, there's a lot that you're saying about the system that we have at the moment that for doesn't really value the way in which black women and brown women who suffer domestic violence can get consistent support. And that's why you've set up Sanctuary for Sisterhood to
That's
offer that,
correct.
sort of support and continuity in a system that's kind of broken in some respects.
Yes.
But I think, go on.
And the reason for the activities is because if we're being honest, no one's going to tell you their story in a day, and no one's going to tell you the reality of their story in a day. But if you use activities that are proven to also support the healing because we're using our hands, and you continue to meet these people on a consistent basis, there's a lot that can be built in those relationships, and that trust can enable you to support them from different angles that other people, say social services and police, can't reach because of their power and the constraints within that power.
I think it would be really interesting to get an example of that. So why are you so passionate about that? You mentioned before, you've been a victim of domestic violence. Would you like to share some of that with us?
Yes. So when I was in my early 20s, I met my child's father. And this is where it gets quite interesting, because a lot of the time when I hear people talking about domestic violence, people are always talking about the signs. And I found that in my situation, I don't think there were any alarming or any red sort of flags. I think it
Red
was just
flag,
in.
the nation of red flags.
Honestly, I just felt like they were normal, I'm going to say, cultural issues. I think among us black people, sometimes we don't get on with our parents, if that makes sense. It's not always, it's sometimes in our childhood something happened and we felt that our parents were responsible in some way, and we kind of held that against them. I hear that a lot, within the circles that I go in. So I didn't feel like him necessarily not having the best relationship with his mom was the biggest indicator that he may be an abuser. He also didn't have the biggest group of friends, but again, neither do I. So I also didn't see that as the biggest red flag. And other than that, at the time, that's all there was. He came to every appointment with me. He cooked and cleaned, he went to work. So it was like, it wasn't until a woman approached me, saying that, she was also dating him, that, he then sort of used that moment and he attacked me. And looking back, I see that a lot of it was to do with his own relationship with his own mother. And the fact that he'd been, abandoned when he was quite young for a long period of time.
So
And
Yeah, I'm hearing what you're saying about him, but you just dropped a bombshell. You caught him having a relationship with someone else. You brought it to his attention,
Yeah.
and he blamed you and took his anger out on you.
Yeah, so he alleges that it wasn't him blaming me, it was him, the shame and the embarrassment that he felt and the desperation because he knew, he said, that the relationship has now ended. He's now lost me. So in a bid to get me back, even though it wasn't, his reaction, let's say, to the situation was to be abusive.
So that was just physical.
Yes, it was that time it was physical.
And obviously that plants a seed in your mind, and that wasn't a red flag for you.
No, see, it was. That was the red flag. But the problem was I was 9 months pregnant. So I'm also very, very
Oh.
vulnerable. Yes. So I'm very vulnerable. I'm very confused because nothing's happened up until this point. And then at 9 months, we get just like a whole hurricane of violence. And it's like, I was starstruck. I don't know if that's the right word, but I was stunned.
You were dumbstruck. You were
Dumbstruck,
actually,
that's the
you were
word.
just shocked. I would have been just shocked.
Yeah, and I remember the next day I called the ambulance to make sure everything's okay because I couldn't feel any movement and things
Right.
like that. And I remember that's when it started because they asked me what happened and I just lied and it just came out of my mouth without me even thinking about it. And it's only after that I realized why that had happened. And that was like I was saying before, that was the whole I've been as a child, I witnessed domestic violence. It happened between my mum and my dad. And so through that relationship of my mum saying, don't tell anybody or social services will come and take you away from us, I already innately learned to keep secrets, learned to keep that part of my life from everyone. So
Yes.
even when my friends would say, how come you didn't tell us? How didn't we know? I didn't know. I'm like,
It's
I don't
norm.
know.
It seems the norm because I grew up and the same thing. There were couple of things that they would say. I mean, I'm a different generation, but it's interesting how we're still saying the same story. Don't tell people, to lie. If because I remember one time my mum beat me so bad that I had wales on my skin that just would not go down. And so I couldn't do PE and stuff like that. And I couldn't roll up my sleeves for things. And I was just beaten because I'd been a disobedient or I'd done something wrong. But from the beginning, it was always like, don't bother tell nobody. Nobody can save you. If you tell social services will take you away. You know what I mean? So you almost feel like this is the devil I know. The social service is what I don't know. So I better, I might as well stay where I am. Do you understand what I mean? So when you say
Definitely.
lie, it's not, it's if you've grown up like that with don't trust the police, don't trust social services, you kind of like don't see a red flag then, I suppose. Do you know what I mean?
Especially because I guess a lot of the growing that I had to do made me recognize a lot of things. So, for example, my mom, I'm from Congo, my parents are both Congolese.
Right.
So where I come from culturally, it's a bit of a norm, if we're being honest. So if we would have been back home, my dad beating up my mom wouldn't really have been considered anything to call any police about. It's
Right.
something in their home between a man and his woman. The worst case scenario is they would take it to the elders and maybe the elders would get involved and, tell him not to do that or whatever. But ideally, they're in their home, so it wouldn't. So when my mom came here, you have to remember that it takes a long time, especially at that age, to change a mindset,
Yeah.
and especially when you're still learning the language, also still learning the laws and legislations of a country. So my mom didn't necessarily understand the severity of domestic violence the way in which you and I do now
Right,
at that
right.
time. So she only had limited information and resources for herself, let alone for us, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. Yes, I
Where
understand.
I've
That's why I'm not interjecting. Go on,
Yeah.
talk, sister, talk.
Where I think the disconnect was is where there was no conversation between my mum and us, where she laid it out and said, you know what? I'm sorry you guys had to go through that. it was wrong. Your father should have never, been, and just explain that. Because there was no conversation, that left a void in which I made my own conclusion on what I
Right.
saw, which was, you know what? You have a man, you love the man. He may not be the greatest man. In this case, he's violent. Stay with him, stick with him. He will change if he sees that there's a woman that loves him, which is not, that's not it.
That's not the
That's
truth.
not.
Listen, that's not the truth, even in normal relationships. I mean, I've
Nope.
got adult girls now, right? And the one thing I keep saying to them is, do not believe who you see, believe the actions that they show you. And then you have to make a decision. Are they prepared to change for themselves? Because you sacrificing yourself for them to change is never going to happen. They have got to want to change for themselves, and they've got to want to put actions in that show that they want to change for themselves. So if, look, when I started dating my first boyfriend, and I'm way old, right? But this is way, way back. For women, and this sounds funny, right? But for women, we change our underwear every day. He didn't. He hadn't been taught that he needed to change his boxer shorts every single day. And when I started going out with him, I was like, that's nasty. I ain't getting involved with that. You need to change every day. And it's only because he saw how I operated and he changed that. I was like, okay, we can continue. You know what I mean? That's a small thing. But some people, if you don't see their willingness to change, don't stay. But
Definitely.
sometimes it's too late when you get married already, and then they reveal themselves. So anyway, so yes, so for you, it was a case of like, this has been revealed. This is what my mother never had that conversation with me. I thought I could change, or she didn't say, she didn't really say about that at all in her
Yeah.
comments to you.
No. And I think then I'm in this position where I'm 9 months pregnant. I've started building this home with this man, I've left my mother's home with this man, because bearing in mind before that, he was living with us at my mum's for a bit. And he got to meet my mum again, no red flags there, everything was fine. So then when we moved in together, it was like we've gone together, My mum's like, you're fine, you're okay over there,
You've left home. Don't bother come back. You can manage.
Exactly. So now I'm then in this headspace where my mum's always had this, as well as, let's be honest, society, a negative stigma on single moms.
Of
So in my
course.
head, a lot is going on. I'm thinking, oh my God, like I didn't plan to be a single mom. So now, and as well as that, let's not forget the man is, he's now in that stage of domestic violence where he's apologetic. He's doing between apologetic and look what you made me do, kind of thing, because that's what they do. They will take some owners just to make you feel like they feel bad, but at the same time, they're still manipulating you because somewhere, somehow, the dialogue is that you did something to make them do that. In a sense, you always get that, look what you made me do. If you hadn't have done that, I would have never did that. This is how much I love you. Like, this is what you do to me. And because you've had all of that love bombing that you didn't realize at the time was love bombing before, you're already at a stage where I believed that. I genuinely thought this was just a slip up. He's not like that. He's never done that to me before. I've always had this version of him. So this person is, we're having a baby soon. Maybe he's scared, Men don't really talk about their feelings. So in my head, I'm really there just making excuses. That's what it was, if we're being honest. I was making excuses for his behavior. Funnily enough, I called my friend and she said the same thing. She was like, it's the first time he's never done anything like this before, has he? I'm like, no. She goes, so do you know what? Let's play it by ear, kind of thing. That's
Oh,
kind
it's a
of what I
blip.
got.
It's a blip. It's a
Yeah.
blip. This isn't
Yeah,
really
yeah,
him.
yeah. Yeah. Bearing in mind, that's the only person I told at that time. So I just thought, you know what? She's right. It's a blip. Except it wasn't a blip. It was basically, he just basically in my head, he's seen now what the limitations are. And he's now seen, okay, so I can do that. I've done that. She forgave me. So I can cross that boundary. But then it became every time he didn't get his own way or he didn't like the way things were going, he didn't trust me or whatever his reasoning was, he would just hit me, strangle me. I don't know how explicit I can be on here, but
Girlfriend, you can, look, they can't demonetize me because I'm not making money. All right.
he used the fact that I didn't work at one point, he
Right.
used that as a point of exchanging sexual favors for finances. So if I
Lovely.
needed something, he would kind of say to me, like, look, if this is what you want, you have to do X, Y, and Z for it, oral sex or whatever his thing
Whatever
may have
he
been at the time
decided,
that he wanted.
he was in control.
Yes. And there were
Anything.
times where if he didn't get it, he would, force himself on me. First he would be violent and then use that vulnerability that came from that to then proceed to having sex.
And by now you've had the child.
Yes, the child is a few months old now. And I'll be honest, I was numb now. So I've mentally checked out. I've reported, I've called the police. I haven't called the police yet, sorry. I'm in that stage where there was even a time where I slept with a knife under my pillow. And I just said, you know what? Tomorrow it's going to be the day. Forget it. I can't do this anymore. But then I had to go through the motions of my child, who will look after her, and just do I is he worth doing prison time for? Definitely not. So, I was really just trying to find my way out, because that's the thing that people didn't realize. After a while, I had to go to work because he couldn't maintain a job after a while. He lied that he had a job, but then I found letters that he'd been fired. So it was like I had to then take a consecutive decision that we needed money. So I had a degree. So I said, look, I'm going to go to work. You're going to stay home and look after our daughter. Now, doing that was where it kind of got to the last straw, because he didn't like that. That gave me power, because I could come home later when I. So when you then leave and you go somewhere else and you're meeting people, you're starting to realize that that ain't it. I'm meeting men who are, talking to me and saying, something's wrong with you. You don't look right. You're skinny. What's wrong? And when I'm starting to talk to people, they're telling me, that is not a good relationship. You need to get out of that. I can help you. If you need me to come with you to pack your bags, like, I will be there for you, but you need to get out. And I'm starting to look myself in the mirror and I don't like what I'm seeing. I don't like the scars. I don't like the weight. I don't like the sadness. And I'm starting to think, maybe these people are right. The icing on the cake was I had a my manager, she was actually going through the same thing as me. And I think one day she'd come into work and she'd just been beaten up. So she came into the break room and she just sat there. And I can't remember what I said to her, but I said something and she just burst into tears. And she just started telling me, and it felt like looking in the mirror 20 years later. And I said, nah, I don't want to be here in 20 years. I'm a working woman managing a service and I'm still dealing with that when I go home. And I got
I
kids.
think yeah, and I think that having gosh, man, you mentioned you've got a degree, and I think some people assume that domestic violence can only happen with people who don't have an education, right? It can
No.
only happen with people who don't have like a good job. Yeah, it can only happen to those who it can only happen to those who are just insecure. You understand? But you never started from that point, and you never presented, and you stayed for a period of time. Why?
So this is where we get interested. I stayed for a number of reasons. So first of all, when I was working, he always used our daughter, even or if I ever thought of doing anything that would impact this family unit he wanted us to have, he would take her.
That's scary.
Very, because I didn't know where he'd take her.
And also, you're at work trying to manage what you're doing, but in your head, you're also like, if I'm planning to, if I don't get home by a certain time and he thinks that I'm not coming back, he could take my daughter and I could go home to an empty flat. That's psychological.
Exactly that. And because at that time I didn't know his family as well as I do now, I
Right.
didn't know who I could call or who could, just in case he'd try and go there or whatever. So I didn't know anybody like that to
Right.
feel like I could take that risk. if that makes sense.
Yeah, it
And
makes perfect sense.
on top of that, if we're being honest, I was alone. Like at that time, I'd ostracized a lot of people because of this relationship. I couldn't pretend all the time. I didn't have the emotional agility to go out and network with these people anymore. So anytime they'd invite me places, I didn't want to go. So then they got tired of me making excuses or just not showing up, that they kind of distanced themselves from me. So if I'm being honest, then comes a time when I'm, you know, we get into a, I'm not going to call it a fight. He attacks me and I look and I see my blood on the floor and I say, do you know what? I can't. So I call my mom and she comes. And my mom, she sides with him. She basically, yeah, she turned around and alludes to the fact that if I wasn't doing whatever it is he thinks I'm doing, I wouldn't be catching these licks, you know,
How the hell did that make you feel?
I was confused. I was so confused because for me, that was a cry for help. Like, I have called my mom and I'm saying at this point, take me with you. You left and you left me here. Like, until now, I always think if I hadn't have got myself out of there, you'd have basically left me to be dead to dead. Like, you'd have left me there to die.
So that is so like that's heavy.
It is. And I had to do a lot of work, a lot of psychotherapy to work on that anger that I have to towards my mom, towards myself, because you know, a lot of the time people do ask you why you stay. And a lot of the time, even though it was a year, it was a long year. And you know, I'm quite proud of myself of when I did leave, I never ever went back, if that makes sense.
So when I said why, one of the key things was about your daughter, right? Why you stayed. The other was you were alone, you felt isolated from other people. So who could you trust? Who could you reach out to? Was there any other reasons why you stayed?
Yeah, if we're keeping it 100, like the young people say, if we're being really honest, I genuinely love that man. And it broke my heart to really be in a situation where I've had my first child. I'm 21 when I've conceived this child. I'm 22 when she's born. I've just finished my first degree. In my head, I'm like, this is supposed to be a good time in my life. I was supposed to have enjoyed the pregnancy, enjoyed that part of being a mother, and I didn't. It was absolutely horrible. And I thought I loved this man, and that went absolutely horrible. And you know, a part of me really just really wanted it to work. So I guess a part of me really just tried to see if maybe it was a blip and if maybe having that child and seeing that I'm a good woman and I'm not going anywhere despite the man you are choosing to be, maybe that would have done something to him, but it didn't. So when the last incident happened, that was like the, what do they call it? The straw that broke the camel's back, and it was it.
So how did you find the strength? You mentioned like it was a year. So you planned for a year before you left, or was it just like after a year you were just like, no, I've had enough, that's it, I'm gone.
Yeah, after a year, like I said, the last incident, that was just, it was enough. I, like, you know, my body took over and my legs just went. So what had happened was we'd been in the house, my daughter was in her bedroom. So we'd now had, we're on 14 incidents of violence. On the last one, he broke a buggy over my head. So that was where it was just like, I'm 5 foot 1, by the way. He's 6 foot 2. So all the dynamics, I'm always going to be, let's say, you know, I'm the
You're always
smaller
going to
part.
lose,
Yes.
you
So
know.
I'd already decided from the offset that I'm not even going to try and retaliate because I felt like if I retaliated, all I was doing was making him more angry and the impact was going to be more. Does that make sense? So I would always try to use pleading and just try to use kindness and really try to avoid even being in that situation. But sometimes you couldn't because once they were enraged, everything you did would just further the rage. So that day, he'd gone through my phone. There was this those spams that you get from those men in abroad. So this
Oh
was a
gosh,
spam from
yeah.
a Nigerian man saying he would like to marry me. My daughter's dad, for some reason, believed this was real thing and I was invested in this. So I'm in the shower, having my shower. He's now kicked through the door because the door's locked. He's kicked through it. And obviously I've heard that. So I've already kind of got into fight, flight,
Right
freeze
off,
mode and I've
yeah.
frozen. I'm like, okay, here we go again, kind of thing. Because remember at this point, this is kind of my norm now.
Right.
So I already know how this could go. Now he's coming and he's throwing the allegations. I'm like confused. So I'm like, no, be serious. Like, I'm like, this guy is in another country. Like, be for real. Long story short, he then throws my phone at me in the bath. And obviously, iPhone being iPhone, bath being a bath, it completely shattered. Like, the whole thing was just demolished in the
Right.
bath. So I'm distraught now because that's my only communication with the outside world. That's my only thing that I can call 999 with, you know, like
Yeah.
protect me and my daughter with. So I'm thinking, oh my God, so it's gonna get worse. I can see that this is gonna get worse from here. So then he's attacked me, and the thing that threw me was he started spraying bleach at me. So bleach being what it is, I've screamed. I've then got back into the bath because that's the only thing I can think of. Because but then at this point the bath is also dangerous. It's got all the bits of my phone in it,
Yeah.
and all that. So I've tried to get in the bath, do the water, and then I'm not gonna lie, after he's picked up, there's pieces of metal that partition flooring.
Yes.
He's picked that up off our floor because it's already quite loose. He's then started to hit me with that. So I've kind of been sort of running around between the living room and the bathroom area, picked up a towel, and I've walked out my front door. I ran out of my front door in my towel, no shoes. I ran all the way down to the bottom of the building. And my neighbors were there. And turns out they could hear everything. That's why they were all down there. They were all trying to figure out what they should do because they'd been hearing things for weeks, months, but they didn't want to call the police in case that got me and like took my daughter away or
Yes,
anything like that.
so
So
yeah.
they always were trying to catch me on my own, but they never really got the chance to. So, you know, they all assembled around me and, are you all right? You know, do you need anything? Oh my God, you must be freezing. Someone call the police and can we call the police? And long story short, they called the police. That was the first time I'd ever called the police, by the way, after all
In
of
all
these
the incidents, that's the first
all
time
the
you called the
incidents.
police.
Yes. That was the first time I'd ever called the police. So it was all very scary because now in my head I'm like, oh my God, what am I gonna say? Do I say today? Do I
Yeah.
say 14 other times? Like, you know, there was a lot going through my head. My daughter's still upstairs with him, bear that in mind.
Of course,
But in my head, I know he's not gonna hurt her. He's never hurt her in all
yeah,
these times. It's always
yeah.
just been me. So then I've told someone that. So one of them has gone, do you want me to go upstairs? I've gone, no, because he's still up there. I don't want you to get into a situation. He's not listened. The man's then gone up there. They've then got into it a bit because he's felt threatened by this man. So he said,
Felt threatened
police.
by another man, but not by a woman.
Exactly. So then the police have come. They've done separate sort of trying to find out what's happened. They've seen the metal thing, taken that as evidence. They've taken pictures of my, you know, my bruises and whatever. And then they've taken him. And then this is where the psychological stuff happens because I went and withdrew my statement.
Yeah,
I think the
like
next
so
day.
many. Yeah, so like, sorry.
Yeah. But do you know
Hang
what?
on,
I'll
hang
be
on, no,
honest.
hang on. Did I heard you? I was saying like so many women who, you know, to say, okay, I'm withdrawing my statement. But what did you just say?
I withdrew my statement the next day. I went to the police station and I withdrew my statement. I told them, they asked me why, and I said, and I stand by this in the sense of I don't stand by withdrawing my statement. I stand by the reasoning because this is again where I blame the system. The way the system deals with domestic violence perpetrators doesn't work. So for me, I felt like this would have gone two ways. He would have gone to prison and he would have envied me more for this
Right.
situation and probably made my life more hell, or he wouldn't have got convicted, which is what happened, and he would have then made my life hell anyway, which is what
Right.
happened. So I was saying, better in my head, better I find a way to self-manage the situation than leave it to you guys and you make it worse. But obviously, that was my young mind speaking, because either way, there always has to be a punishment or some sort of end for that kind of behavior, if that makes sense.
I'm stunned by you thinking self-management after you've been abused by this man. You still have it in your head that you can manage this individual.
Like, not so much manage the individual, but manage the situation. Yes, I really had this idea that because it was a situation that had happened between the two of us of his making, that it would take the two of us to fix it. I obviously learned the hard way that that wasn't the
Well, you
case.
know, I think there's many people who are listening who will be in situations like this and think exactly that, just like you've just said, you know, it took two of us, we can manage it. We don't need the police, we don't need any external services. And especially when you're black and brown, I'm not white, so I don't know if it works out better. But I think violence is violence at the end of day, regardless. And manipulation is manipulation. So how successful were you? Well, you said you did say, you know, that was then. And I suppose you're still working things through because you have got a child.
So this is where it gets interesting. This is the one time where I actually respected the system. The system told me that at this point, it was beyond it's beyond me. So even though I withdrew my statement, the system said it was in the public interest to prosecute regardless. So I still had to go to court. I still had to stand by that statement, regardless of the fact that I withdrew it. And in that moment, that's when I learned that it was really that bad, because they said to me, I'm sorry that you're trying to withdraw a statement, but we're not going to allow you to do that because this is bigger than you. We need to make an example of this man and this situation. So we went to court.
Oh, in
They
my head,
gave me an interview.
I'm like, are you doing this for everybody? You know, every woman, regardless of color and culture, or are you just trying to make example of this black man, this 6 foot black man? Do you understand? I mean, let's be real.
Of
I mean,
course.
you know, let's
Of
keep it
course.
100. At the end
Of
of the day,
course.
I disregard, you know, there are some questions. Are you pursuing certain cultures more than others with regards
Of
to this?
course. Of course. And
Not
that's
saying that
why
the
I.
domestic violence isn't, you know, it is a case for this person to be arrested. But is the system like this for all of us? All,
No, I agree with you.
A-L-L.
I agree with you. And I think, especially because I was young, I had that mindset. Growing up as a young black woman with friends, male, black, and brown friends who were dead, incarcerated at that time,
Yeah.
I had a different outlook on the system. I felt like, and I'd also been through my own encounters with Metropolitan Police, So at that time, I felt like, despite what he'd done, the system wouldn't treat him fairly. They would look at him and see a monster, even though he was doing things that could perceive him that way. I felt like they would sit him next to murderers and people like that and give him the same thing. And I didn't think that was fair. And I think that impacted a lot of the decisions I made regarding our case, because
Right.
I felt like he will get the same as someone doing way more than him. And he won't learn his lesson because of that,
Right.
because he will sit there feeling like a judged black man. And
Yeah.
when a black man or a black person feels like the system's doing them wrong, even if they've done something wrong, they're going to become ignorant. Does that make
Yeah.
sense?
Yeah,
And I
you
didn't
are
want
not
that to be the
100.
lesson.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes
So
sense.
when we went to court, I did a victim impact statement, and I said to them, look, this man did something to me and it hurt, and it's had such an impact on my life that I don't even know who I am when I stand here before you today. But he is also a black man, and he's also the father of my child, and he's been through his own things. Does that make sense? So I
Yeah.
ask you that whatever the punishment be, it be something that can better my daughter's life, that
Yeah.
will make that he can be the father she needs and not worsen him as a man.
Yeah.
What did they do? They gave him a course he never attended. They gave him things he never did, and they never followed up.
Okay.
Never. For 3 years, it took them to then call and say, we're calling him back in because he didn't do what he said. Last year was the first time they arrested him at Gatwick Airport for crimes he committed in 2017 and 2020.
What madness? So then, why did you go through all of that?
And that's why I understand, not that I condone, but that's why I understand when people don't want to go through the criminal justice system, because you have to go through appointments, court, all of that, reopening trauma. I had to watch the, what do they call it? The body cam footage of when they came to my house that day when I was in my towel. I had to revisit that experience in front of loads of people, you know, who don't know my life, who don't know my story. For them,
So you were saying that 3 years they did nothing. They didn't follow up on the outcome of the criminal case that was brought against him. So what
yes.
happened to you in those 3 years?
So it's funny because it started, so 2017 we go to court, you know, there's the bail conditions of no contact, so obviously he has to then move out. But then even him moving out, he came back to the house despite the fact that he was bailed to not be at my address. He still was like, well, where do you want me to go? You know, I don't have, my family don't live in London. I don't really have a good relationship with my brothers. Where am I going? So then I'm like, what do you, what, why is that my business? You know, so I had to call the police and sit on this. I remember I had to sit in outside the steps of my house because I didn't want to be in the house with him, on the phone to the police. And they're like, has he left yet? I'm like, no, are you going to come and get him out? Like, you know, and for the 3 years that preceded, it was what they don't tell you about. The part that basically, when people say sometimes better the devil you know, I really learned to understand that, because living with him meant I could predict his moods. I could predict when and why he would be violent. Now, he's not in my house anymore. I can't predict his mood. I don't know how he's woken up. So I don't predict him trying to climb through my window, not trying, climbing through my window to get inside my property. I don't predict him breaking in and trashing my flat. You know, I don't predict him stalking me, but he was able to do all those things. I don't know where he lives. Every time I call the police are saying, I'm afraid he has no fixed address. We can't find him. I'm calling housing to move me. Housing is saying, we don't know where he is, so we don't know where you can live.
Oh my
So
gosh.
for 6 years, I've had to navigate keeping me and my daughter safe, just calling the police, having to just build on case reports, on case reports, on case reports, on case reports, and then having to close them because they can't find him. There's no solution. So it's been really exhausting because in that time, he's been doing, you know, he's been having a life. And I've seen that on social media and, you know, in different ways. He's got business. I've seen that on. And it's like, how have you not found him? I've found him. You
Well,
know what I
no
mean?
one's tracking your case because there's too many cases.
Yeah, that's the other
They're
thing.
not tracking your case. So this is when you're saying that, you know, Sanctuary for Sisterhood is needed for that continuity of support, whereas they probably will give you a certain amount of time of their effort and energy and attention, but you're still left living in that circumstance.
After, what was it, a year or two of being, you know, free of him, I went back and I got a master's in social work because I was like, look, I don't understand, so I'm going to learn so I can understand, if that makes sense, and use that understanding to help other people who don't understand.
But
I will
also
help
help yourself.
MIFRAs. Yes, I'll be able to navigate a system better because I have access to the resources.
But reality check, man, how much women, right, are going to do a master's to understand the system that impacts them when they're trying to live day by day with somebody, as you've said, you know, he of no fixed abode. So they can't move you to a place that's safe. No job, allegedly, right? What's left for you? What support? Sanctuary is needed, isn't it?
And this is where I sat. And then, do you know what the killer was? Lockdown. When lockdown came, and thankfully for me, I was with someone that was, you know, it was a great person. But I started to think about it and I thought, Damn, imagine I was locked in with him.
You're
So
dead.
imagine how many women are locked in with a him at that time. And that's when I started to build on the idea of a sisterhood, the idea of having a network of that would give access to an abundance of resources that can support women whenever, wherever, because my situation don't stop after 5 p.m.
Yeah, that's true.
My situation can't wait till 9 a.m.
Yeah.
I can't wait on a waiting list for 6 weeks for to then just have a 6 week program that at the end of it, I'm still left sitting here thinking, so am I supposed to be healed now? Am I fixed? You know?
Look, I say a lot. Two things, right? Well, I'm sure I'll say more than two things. I was working through lockdown, supporting families who had lost income, lost everything, you know what I mean? And they needed support. And I know that that was a very stressful time for you without having the threat of physical violence. And it surprised me. I did a lot of work on mental health. I was part of a task force. And one of the things that I was, saying in these spaces was, first of all, there's lots of invisible voices that you're not even tapping into. There's going to be a massive mental health fallout from COVID. And, it's proven that domestic violence shot up during COVID. Yeah. Now, if you're telling me that in the last 6 years you have tried to manage and the system has not helped you really. You know what I mean? Yes, they've taken him to jail, not jail, they've taken him to court, they've put something on the system about him. But they've not actually been able to do anything to prevent him from interfering in your life. Okay. What do we think is going to happen? Who There are millions of people out there suffering domestic violence, millions, and the system just cannot cope. It can't cope with the mental health issues alone of those who are not suffering from, domestic violence or domestic abuse. So how are they going to manage with this on top? And the children who were impacted.
Because my daughter didn't speak for the first 2 years of her life, and it's only after that I realized that was why. You know, they kept saying, oh, she's got autism, and you know, I have worked with children, you know, with learning difficulties and things like that. And as a mother, you just know. And I just knew it wasn't that. I took her to the test. They diagnosed it wasn't that. You know, I did everything. And then once I started healing, I realized she started growing. You know, things started happening the way they were supposed to. And I realized it wasn't me, but it was me in a sense that she felt the void. You know, like she felt the absence of my mental presence, because it took me a long time to get my feet on the ground in terms of who am I now? Like, I don't like what I look like. I don't like what I feel like. I don't like how I feel like I've been treated and why everybody seems to be pointing the finger at me. What am I going to do about
And in this
it?
mindset, that's you do a master's.
Yeah. Because that's all I know. One thing about me, it's always been my character. Anytime life starts lifing or it gets hard, I go into tunnel vision and I focus on something and
Right.
I get results to then, because in my head, I'm like, if I sit and cry about it, the world is going to keep going. Women are still going to keep it being abused and I'm going to keep feeling at it. So I
Right.
get up and I take this anger and I take this passion that I have for what I've been through and put it into something, I will see some result that will either help me or help other women or both. And that's what happened. Although it was hard and there were so many down days where I just had to be like, why me? Why couldn't I just have the story where I met someone, we had a kid, it didn't work out, but you know, we could co-parent or whatever. I get this. You know? And again, I always say there's no one out there teaching you how to then co-parent with this person, because this is the thing that society seems to forget. I have a child with this man. So, yes, he was my abuser, but legally, he didn't do nothing to her. That's what the courts say. Legally, he didn't do anything to that child. So, legally, he has a right to be in her life.
Oh, wow.
They don't tell me what that looks like, though. They don't advise me. If you talk to people about family court and domestic violence do not work well together. There is no proper protection for women who are survivors next to their perpetrators who are also the father of their children.
Wow.
There's a disconnect there.
Yeah, there's a disconnect in this whole system, you know? There's a
Definitely,
disconnect. It's
definitely.
almost like you have to join the dots. And then once you've joined the dots, then you see the gaps, yes, that don't take into account. Yes, he might not have, when they talk about what is it? When you got trauma, and it's like when you smoke. So they've put all these laws in place to prevent passive smoking. So you know that something's happening to those who are inhaling your fumes, right? So you've put laws in place, no smoking here, blah, 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 vaping, all the rest of it, all these other strategies. So common sense would say that your daughter, although she hasn't physically been abused, right? She's been traumatized by the experience. So you should still protect her. So why put the child in that environment or access potential? You know, because he's not going to be talking about you, I'm assuming, and it's assumption, but I don't think he's going to be talking about you in a very positive light.
And this is why it took so long for me to allow him, like, and I'm gonna say allow. People might not like that word, but I'm gonna say allow because I raised her by myself for a long time before I was able to say, okay, she's old enough now, she talks. She has more understanding of dynamics and people. So she can go somewhere with him and turn around and say, I would like you to take me back to my mom. And he would have to do that. And he knows if he didn't, she also knows she can call the police. She can let someone in, the member of the public on the street know. She's aware now of her power and her voice. And that's the only reason she's now, and because she asked, I'll be honest, my daughter turned around one day and she said, look, I love you, mom, but I have a dad and I would love to see what that looks like because I've been with you for a long time and I just want to see. And I'm not gonna lie, that really hurt me because I'm like, why? He ain't done nothing for you. But I get it. As someone whose dad left and, was absent for a long time, I get it.
Yeah, but no one
Despite
tells
how,
you how to navigate. You're right. No one
no,
tells you how to navigate that.
no.
Support you, unless you've mentioned therapy and psychotherapy. And I think if people listen to prior podcasts, I have mentioned that I ha also have been in therapy. And I think you need that space to work out
Definitely.
things for yourself and
Yeah.
create boundaries around what you're willing to accept, what your worthiness is, as well as, you know, get some of the toxic shit that's going on out of your body, out of your mind, out of your spirit, in order for you to think clearly about steps and how you would manage those steps. And until you've been in that shoe, nobody can tell you. You know, therapy seems to be a white people thing, right? But it isn't. It's for everybody.
Especially I speak as a black person, you do not realize how much trauma we come with until you start to realize your trauma, like the childhood trauma, the cultural trauma, the generational trauma. There's so many different, and then even just what you've experienced, because I'm an African woman with a British identity, and it can be conflicting because I know more about my British identity than my African identity. But I've also been raised, because I've had foster carers, and I've lived with my friends with Caribbean people. So I'm very much kind of, so
You're a
sometimes,
mix.
yes, and sometimes that can be conflicting in terms of what my expectations are from my black community, in terms of who I'm supposed to show up as, what I'm supposed to sound like, and then living as a in Britain, what Britain allows us to do and what it tells us we should be doing. You know what I mean? And then just being a woman,
So let's just take it back a little. So you did this master's degree, right, in social, was it social work?
Yes, social work.
And what did you discover from doing that?
Honestly, huh. So you actually realize that just like with the police and with all these other agencies, n nothing's black and white. There's loopholes, there's I understood why people didn't come to us, basically.
Right.
My job was to basically go into people's houses. I was a social worker for children with disabilities. So I specifically went into a house where one or more children had disabilities. I would then come into your house and I would sit in your house and make a judgment based on what you're telling me, what I can see, and what my professional judgment says I should be thinking, right? So first of all, I'm intruding because who am I? I'm just a person with a degree, you know. I'm no better than you, but the law says because I have this degree and this HCPC backing, I can come into your house and do this. That's first, yeah? So I'm coming in a point of power. I've got this clipboard, this pen, and I'm writing things. And you know that what I write is going to have an impact on your life, good or bad. So that's another thing. So I have to be mindful that you're going to tell me things based on what the image you want to portray. So that could either be true or false in reality. I also have to bear that in mind that I could leave here and make a judgment that could really go wrong and that could impact my career. So that's another thing. We've all seen it with Baby P, what happened to that social worker. She even tried to come to our university and she was declined. They said that Brunel University couldn't be aligned with her because it could impact our reputation. And all she wanted to do was tell her story and explain how, as a social worker, you can get it wrong. You know? So I would go in there and I would make decisions. Well, at least I thought I would. So I would write this report. I would then give it to my manager, who would do it one of two things. He would either go, "Ah, I'm really sorry that this is what they're living like, but you've got to go and tell them that we ain't got a budget for this. There's not much we can do for
Simple.
them." So I'm like, yeah, but
But
I
after they've
just showed
done, you've just poured their heart out and need help, but the budget is the key thing.
and you're sending me. You are not the one that's going to have to go and break that bad news. Me, who sat there with mum, seen her cry, seen the cramped spaces she's living in, seen six kids in one room, and I have to go back and tell mum that there's nothing we can do because we don't have the budget. But then I know that in another case, we've got the budget for them, and their situation in my eyes is not as severe. Does that make sense? So, and then I met my own, you know, I met black women and they tried to make her situation seem like she had a man in the house sexualizing her child, when really her child just had sensory needs. And he just touched. And it just happened to be that he was touching teachers' boobs. But it wasn't specifically that he was looking for. He just liked the feel. And I had to go in there and I had to push for them to look at other things. Mum had to bring her sister, who happened to be a GP. We had to do some roundtable meeting and get them to move away from that
That
ideology and just
narrative.
look at the child, that narrative, and just look at the child himself and his needs. Even though I was successful in getting them to help him, we built a sensory room, we got him a one-to-one support who was chosen by his mum. I ended up getting reported by the school. They said that I was too aggressive. I came in tag teaming with mum. Yeah. And things like that made me not stay. I didn't stay on as a social worker. I decided that I was going to take the knowledge and use it to help other people, but I did not want to work for social services because my beliefs and the way I want to support people weren't aligned with the way in which, like, the capacity I had to support people.
And I think that happens to a lot of us. You know, people say to us, as I'm Black British, I was born here, I was raised here, of Caribbean descent, which is my tagline. And it is different. They say to you, you're English. My mum says to me, you're a British. So, you know, it will be easier for you. But once you go into the system, like I used to teach, and the way in which I would do certain things or try to advocate with a cultural lens on the way in which you're trying to implement your policy and how it doesn't work for this group of learners, and even with the teaching staff, getting them to change the way in which they taught, which they should have taught all along, you know, eclectically, so that everybody in the room, or at least 95% in the room, will get the knowledge. And what was I was finding was that people specifically wanted to teach their way, and if you couldn't get it, that's your problem. But I thought moving up the academic ladder to a point of power, in inverted commas, would allow me to make the system better for the learners that were coming. So we would adapt to them. And again, number one thing was budget. This is not in the budget. And I'd be like, well, these students are paying for the course. So if they're paying for the course, the budget should be available, but it's where they decide that they're going to put it. And after fighting in that system for a while and almost losing my mental well-being, I was just like, do you know what? I need to come out. I need to be somewhere else where the company aligns with the values that I have, or the desire to support and help people. And that's why I do what I do, besides. But I understand, I totally hear what you're saying about coming out of that system. So then when you've come out of that, so obviously you're still working and you're still trying to set up or the charity, but you're working within that sphere still and trying to get that message out. What's your vision for what you're trying to achieve?
So, from the work that I've done, just to kind of give you, because I don't think I kind of mentioned where I've sort of come from in terms of my working journey.
Sure.
Initially, for the last 10 years, I'd always worked with children and young people. So I got, like I was saying, I got my youth work degree when I was 21, because I was pregnant in my last year. And then I proceeded to be a youth worker. I did that in pupil referral units, in schools. I also worked for Her Majesty Feltham. I worked there for a year. And again, in that environment, I saw domestic violence play out. The son is his mother's co-defendant because he murdered, or he committed GBH or ABH against the partner to defend his mom. So, or women being in prison because they've murdered their perpetrator, their partner, and just seeing how it plays out in that way, or seeing how a young man is in jail for abusing a woman or murdering his partner because he didn't get his own way. And I'm talking they're 15-year-olds. So it's like you see that no matter where I'm going, even I worked in St. Thomas Hospital on the Evelina Ward, domestic violence was there too. So everywhere I've gone in my journey of working, domestic violence is one of the cause, crime, domestic violence, mental health, substance misuse. They always seem to be at the core of familial issues. And that's where I started to see that for me, the vision of Sanctuary for Sisterhood is to be able to not be an advance, not be women's aid, but be like an extension of all these things, be able to encompass everything that they do, as well as all the other things that women need. So if today, now I've been able to get on board some self-defense workshops, I'm going to see now how being able to give women more tools will help them in that sense. Because I didn't have that. There was never a self-defense class to tell me, you know what, get your power back. I'm not saying use these tools to go beat someone up, but be more equipped, feel more equipped, or at least feel the confidence that if you was ever in a situation or you're out at night, you've got something that you can use to get yourself away. Why do we always have to be victims? Does that make sense? That's why
No,
I don't
Bill,
use the word
I think
victim.
it's a huge vision. It's all to me. What I've just seen is like the system's going to be the system, but what you're trying to offer is some wraparound around that to help people to navigate their way. So if they find themselves at point one, sisterhood can advise and signpost you for other points. If you find yourself at point nine, you've still got sisterhood, the sanctuary, to be able to signpost and get support. And also, I think in that, what's more powerful and what I find in my parent power work is the network of parents. Some will be at the beginning of the journey. Or the first part of disclosing this, others will have worked their way through. And so that kind of sisterhood will be able to create a peer-to-peer network for people. Am I getting your vision?
You're
Sorry.
absolutely spot on. No, you're spot on, because even now, some of my not only are some of my volunteers survivors themselves who are at, a different point in their journey where they have the time and would like to give back, I also have some of my service users who sometimes volunteer for with us, and that has given them confidence and things like that. And they're not working, but they're able to do this because the journey allows them to feel that they can somewhat give back or somewhat be at a place of, I'm kind of feeling okay today. I feel like I can show up and do this for you guys, you know?
And I think, you know, that's something, community is something that we've lost. You know,
Definitely.
after COVID, I think some communities pulled together, because they were community, part of their religion. You know, they came together anyway. They were
They
much
lived
stronger.
together anyway. They all lived on the same estate, so they were clapping for NHS together, so they saw each other at that time, and you know, we're able to build off that.
But I think
Definitely.
as well that all of us, we walk in, we walk in a space that we think we're the only ones walking in it. This is why I was asking you to come and speak to us, because I'm sure that there are many parents out there who are listening, and have been following the podcasts that I have been doing. You're the first one for 2024, and I think that your story is, and I hate the word story, your experience and the way in which you've been managing to handle it is inspirational.
Thank
You
you.
know, the fact that you have set up, or you know, in the process of setting up the charity, although the work has begun a long time ago, and I'm sure people would love to have you back at some point to tell us how that journey is manifesting. If you had through some gems to spit at those who are listening, not to spit, but you know what I mean. you know, three things that you would say. What three things would you encourage the listener who might be at a stage now? We don't know, but you know, what advice would you, and I'm, advice is a difficult word, but what would you have said to your past self then,
So
now?
the three things, the three gems that I wish someone would have really said to me or wrote to me or done, just put my way when I was going through that situation was, number one, it is not your fault. Like, someone's reaction to your action is not on you. Like, no matter what you feel you may have done to this person, you do not deserve that. Like, no one, you know, as human beings, we are allowed to feel safe. We shouldn't. Especially not with someone that you love and care for and you think should love and care for you. You know, same way there's laws that protect us, you have the right to not be, you know, abused. So remind yourself of that when you're in that moment where you're trying to make excuses for that, justify that person's behavior. There is no justification for violence, none. You know, you should be able to live and be okay and not feel like, if I say this, that's going to get me in trouble. Or you should be able to be free. And if you don't feel free, there's a problem. There's a problem. And if you're questioning whether you're free or not, you're not free, because you shouldn't have to question your freedom. Because now I don't question anything I do. I do whatever I want to do. As long as it's safe and, you know, it doesn't harm me and my daughter in any way, I get up. And I do what I want to do. And I never realized the power in that and how restricted I was before when I was in that situation. When I was trying to heal, I still felt trapped. So that's my first one. My second one is, it is not going to stop. They are not going to change. Because they've told you that. They've said, I'm sorry, this is the last time. 20 times. Is not a last time. That is 20 times. And I heard it time and time again. Every apology, every reasoning you can tell, I've heard them all. So when women come to me and they say, he said that, I'm going to say, and then he said that and that and that, right? And I don't say that to make people feel a type of way. I say that because I am just one of many people that have been through the same thing. It's a different guy, but it's the same story with the same ending if you don't take ownership of that story and you change the ending. If I had not have changed my ending, I don't know where I'd be now. And I see people who did not change the ending. And that's not to say that I'm judging them or anything, because not everybody's me. Not everybody had that, you know?
But it's a
But
wake-up call when you see somebody else who's got to the point where, you know, that like you said, when your manager came to work and she broke down in front of you, and you said, I saw myself in the future, and that's not what I wanted.
You don't want to lose. I know people that lost their kids. You don't want to lose your kids. And then you then for the rest of your life blame yourself because social services took your kids away because they felt like you couldn't keep them safe. But that still wasn't your fault because you should have never had to keep them safe. They should have been safe. Does that make sense? So that's why I'm very passionate about that one because that even if they did, let's say they did change, they're not doing that next to you. They cannot change with you two next to each other, living in the same household at that time. It could take 10 years and they may not even really change. It could be that they're no longer violent towards you, but they're verbally abusive or, they're quite narcissistic. The abuse might physically stop. It may just change its form. So I'm always mindful with women to be mindful to returning to an abuser later on in life. Because you still have that trauma and you could become bonded by that. And that could be dangerous. And my last one is two in one. It's two in one gems. The first part of it is love should never feel like that. Love should never feel like bruises. It should never feel like that kind of heartache where you don't know who to be anymore, where you have to be careful of how you turn up. Who you turn up as in case the other person doesn't like it. Having to hide things, yourself, people in your life, even though there's nothing wrong with them, just because someone is going to have something to say or do about it. That's not love. Love shouldn't feel like that. And also, not every man or woman is like that. So don't let that situation close you off from love at some other point in your life when you're ready to receive it. Because best believe when you're ready to receive it, there's good people out there. And I feel like when you go through the situation, because it did to me, it just makes you close off to all men. Like it made me close off to all men. It made me feel like they're all big bad bullies. And it wasn't like that because some of my saviors in these situations were some of my closest black male friends, some of my brothers, So I can't say that, all men are bad because some women are abusers also, let's be honest. So it's just my last gem would be don't let that story become you. Yes, that story is a part of you, but don't let it become your whole person.
Wow. I remember when we were speaking before, you said the trauma is in the walls.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And I think these three gems that you've left are really that powerful. They're really quite powerful, and they're simple. It's not your fault. It's not gonna stop. It's not gonna change. And love never feels like that. Not every man or woman is like that. You mentioned so much in this interview that I've got to ask you at some point if you will come back, because you talked about healing, and you talked about learning to navigate access to your daughter with somebody who has been your abuser, and that's ongoing. And I'm sure that some people will want to know how they can do that. But in the meantime, how would people be able to get in contact with you?
Okay, so we're on Instagram at Sanctuary, the number four sisterhood. We're also on by email, that is info at Sanctuary for Sisterhood, FOR this time, not the number. .co.uk. We have some up and coming events, so please stay tuned to our Instagram. We will have a 6-week project for survivors of domestic violence and abuse and any other sort of essay and things like that. It will be a 6-week project looking at using different tools in to essentially heal as well as women free in their voice. We'll be looking at photography, singing, spoken word, and poetry. So if you're also interested in participating in that or want to know more, we will have an event on the 1st of April, that will be posted on our Instagram, a soft launch.
So we want people to reach out to you at on your Instagram, which we'll put the link in the bio, and the email address we'll put that in the bio as well, so that people will be able to contact you. Is there, before you go, because we have very limited time, is there anything that you need? Do you need volunteers? And if people want to donate, or they would just email you and you would then send them the information that they need?
Yes, if anybody ever wanted to volunteer, donate, or just pop down and see what we do or be a part of the sisterhood, then you're more than welcome. There's no criteria other than being a sister, being a woman, that's all. And we do a lot of projects for children and young people, especially over the holidays. We know what it is with cost of living crisis and things like that, so we try to include everyone. So yeah, just pop us an email or drop us a DM on Instagram. We'll get back to you.
Well, Ornella, as sad as it is, and I'm sure people will say that I haven't interrogated you. And I think the real reason is that this platform is for you to be able to just speak and share with us your experience. It's not an interrogation. I thank you for your honesty and your openness, and your time, because your time's really precious. But I think it's fantastic, the work that you're doing. And, you know,
Thank you.
anything I can do to help promote that, I will do so. We're not offering any, there's no offers. It's called humanity and reaching out and sharing. I remember just before I go that you were talking about, you know, if people, yes, we're two black women, all right, here talking today, but domestic violence happens to women from all shades. So, you know, this is open to all women who, you know, are trying to navigate their way through this, and want the sisterhood support, really. So feel free to DM her or Ornella and her team, and we wish you every single success, my dear.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come in here. And I just want to say one more thing. The Sanctuary for Sisterhood is not just limited to survivors, it's limited, it's for all women. You know, if you're in a point in your life where you're going through something of some sort and you need someone, a sister, you can also reach us to, out to us too. We're not segregating anybody. We all go through things. We're all bounded by the fact that we're women. So yeah, that
I
was that.
love that. Thanks for making that clear. Thank you for making that clear.
No.